You are listening to the JCN Clinic Podcast. The JCN Clinic Podcast is a place where nutritionalists Jessica Cox and Carissa Mason get real about nutrition and living a healthy life. They share with you their passion and their clinical knowledge for a fun, no BS approach to looking after yourself. Please enjoy today's episode and don't forget to subscribe in iTunes.
Hello and welcome to the JCN Clinic Podcast Show. I'm Jessica.
I'm Carissa.
And today we are talking about the long-term effects of eating disorders on the gut. It is quite an interesting topic for us. Carissa and I were just chatting before starting about how over many years of practice we've seen examples of this, which will come up today. But I feel like even just recently we're seeing, well, I've been seeing a few more clients in particular, and I think from what she's saying, likewise. And it's a topic that I don't hear so much about, I would say, even from listening to other podcasts in the health space. I don't feel like this area gets enough attention or discussion. So I'm hoping it's going to be of value. I really don't think I've heard this discussed much.
Yeah, I haven't personally. Don't listen to a lot of podcasts in the health space at the moment. I'm kind of on a different tangent. I feel like I need to get back into the health space. I'm off on my own little world at the moment with podcasts. But no, I do agree. And I also think that classically, eating disorders are kind of lumped into their own basket, more commonly treated, depending on obviously the severity, but more commonly treated in the hospitals and the dietetic space. And then the eating disorder recovery space, which can go on for a very long time, is probably talked about in its own right, but definitely not talked about with, you know, the extensive and long-term, I'm going to say, repercussions of the microbiome. Because obviously I see clients, I know you do as well, and they had disordered eating patterns, you know, maybe a decade ago or 15 years ago, and we're still dealing with microbiome or, you know, functionality or structural gut issue stuff now, but I guess they can be quite frustrated by it and not understand why. But it's like, hang on, we had these years of, you know, almost not irreversible, but pretty harrowing times on the gastrointestinal system, and we've got to, you know, respect that space because there's a lot that happens when you've got disordered eating stuff going on. So yeah, I personally haven't heard it talked about, so I think it's a good one to cover. Good suggestion, yeah. Jess. Well done.
Thanks. Well, one of the things you just said there too, which I think is important, is we're talking about these long-term effects, and with that, it sort of references clients or the person who has had a history around this. And there will be people potentially listening, or people listening who themselves or know someone where there might be something more current, and this will still be definitely of value if there is some form of like current disordered eating. But what Carissa and I are referring to a lot today is where there has been something in the past, and even with that, we'll talk about our thoughts around that, but something usually more so in the past that comes up in our consultation, and how that can be a very significant factor or piece of the puzzle when it comes to health issues, and more so than, again, I think people give credit to, particularly the person who's unwell. It's just like, yeah, that's a past history of mine.
I also think if you're working with a practitioner, whether it's someone at our clinic or any clinic, but if you're someone who's working with a practitioner and you feel like it's not relevant to tell them that you've had disordered eating in the past, I want to tell you that it is very relevant to tell them. I feel like I've had clients that have, and I think it's been getting a little bit more common now to talk about these things with your practitioners, but I definitely know there's a space. And obviously I think there's, you know, an anxiety or a sense of, you know, shame or something about, you know, past eating disorder stuff where people might feel like it's not something they want to go into a lot, or they don't feel like it's relevant to tell us about. But it, yeah, I just want to say how relevant it actually is. Mm-hmm. It's that, and just not the eating disorder itself, but the psychology that surrounds the eating disorder, the stuff that obviously goes on with the gut and the hormones, which Jess and I are going to touch on today, are so relevant for your health now. Mm-hmm. And it also helps us put together treatment plans and have an understanding of how we would tailor things for someone that's got a disordered eating past versus someone who doesn't. So
absolutely. No, really, really good point. So I guess I was thinking, and I hope you guys can't hear that in the background. That's my husband wheeling the wheelie bin at the best time right past the window. how common are eating disorder histories clinically for us? And I touched on this a little bit earlier, but I would say this is a lot more common than perhaps people would suspect. As far as what we see in clinic, like particularly with females, but I have had some males in the past. But it's, we definitely are living in a world where there is a lot more disordered eating behaviors. And that obviously can range from whether it's been a past history with anything from anorexia to bulimia to even orthorexia and obsession around that sort of concept of really controlled healthy eating. Definitely a whole array of those and different spectrums. But I would absolutely highlight that it is something that is more rampant and more prevalent than I think we give value to. Mm. Would you say?
100%. And I'm even going to tap on there. Like, there's obviously the full-fledged eating disorders that are like anorexia nervosa, bulimia. But I also think in the disordered eating space, things that have an impact on your hormones and your microbiome and, you know, your health moving forward, laxative use and abuse, I think is something that's not really talked about a lot. Yo-yo dieting. So even if you're not necessarily someone who's, you know, bulimic or clinically anorexic, you know, you can definitely be someone who's long-term restricted food, or that up and down of yo-yo dieting, whether, you know, like high calorie, low calorie, eat whatever the fuck I want, then restrict, like that over a period of time also affects the gut and the hormones as well. So I think in the disordered eating space, it's really important to acknowledge that, yes, you may not have had anorexia and you may not have had bulimia, but if you've done some sort of time frame, considerable time frame, where you played around with your food and dropped and gained weight, and that whole space is still a disordered eating space, and it still will impact your health in the future, probably, but definitely has impacts on your microbiome and your hormones. So
for sure. Yeah. So let's get into that, hey? So the long-term impacts, because I feel, again, if people listening are like, well, yeah, 10 years ago, I definitely had disordered eating behavior. I had something that I worked through. Now I'm in a good space and I'm taking care of myself, but I'm having these health issues. What we want to explain today is that the complications around eating disorders are pretty diverse as far as their impact. And Chris has already alluded to some of these things, particularly if we started with the gut. The microbiome itself is something that definitely needs to be considered and highly mentioned. When we have, no matter what type of, like, you know, we talk about it from anorexia, bulimia, et cetera, there's different variations of disordered eating, and some of them will have different impacts depending on how that behavior is carried out. But if we fundamentally are having many years in a lot of circumstances of controlled eating, severely reduced calorie intake, rampant stress and anxiety that often comes with these conditions, but particularly even nutritionally, like that starvation of the body, there will absolutely be an impact on the microbiome. We'll see this sometimes, you know, maybe as an analogy where we'll have clients who have restricted themselves down to, say, 5-6 foods because of their gut issues, and we will test their microbiome and see a very, very poor gut as far as diversity and richness. Severe undergrowth, we'll often refer to it as insufficiency dysbiosis, but basically a very decimated gut microbiome. And it's not always so simple to come back from that. Like if we've created such an extreme undergrowth, and also as a result of that undergrowth, depending on what's been going on for that person, there could have also been an overgrowth that's developed. Like when we have a gut that's under such extreme stress, then can be more of a propensity for that gut to create maybe an overgrowth of yeast, or it might be the ability for it to not clear parasites, or particular more inflammatory bacteria, and that might be holding on at a higher abundance amount. So basically that whole microbiome can shift, and as someone is, and I'm going to say inverted commas, like recovering from their disordered eating and their diets is diversifying ideally, that's great, but it may and often is not enough to shift that microbiome. And that is a lot of what we will see years and years and years later, where someone with past disordered eating is struggling with ongoing food sensitivities. They feel food sensitivities. That'll be something that they would often come to us saying. A lot of bloating, a lot of IBS type symptoms, and generally that impact on the gut microbiome has played a really pivotal role in that. I would also say, I mean, there's a lot more, of course, gut-wise, but the other one I would just mention would be upper gastric distress. Again, this can be due to an array of different circumstances, but with respect to bulimia and the impact of that and the inflammation that happens in the esophagus and the stomach, again, like you see so much literally like structural inflammation and potentially like functional damage that has a long-term effect as well. I mean, the gut's amazing and its ability to recuperate and regenerate to some capacity, but often that upper gastric symptomology can be a really big presentation as well. And then even with that, potentially SIBO being a component too. That I say that in relation to something like bulimia, because I think that that's such a huge another inflammatory layer on top of disordered eating. But definitely, like, you can't, you just, even to come back to like that severe calorie restriction, how much it has like such a profound effect on that microbiome is like one of the sort of bigger key factors as far as the gut goes, besides some others I can think of, but I'll shut up for a minute and see if there's anything that you want to add.
I think even in the bulimia space, like, it's probably like you're mentioning the, I guess, like that, yeah, that inflammatory response, and I know you're sort of alluding and going down the road of like the effects on, you know, the hydrochloric acid and the secretions there. But I also think like what ends up happening, well, not I think, like what can end up happening for a lot of people is because they damage their esophagus so much, where they end up with, you know, that they end up with GERD or some sort of esophageal reflux disease quite young, or it gets diagnosed in their 30s or their 40s. So something that realistically, you know, will more commonly be diagnosed later in life. And then as a result, because they've already got that sort of, you know, reflux disease happening and that scarring or, you know, inflammation in the esophagus, even if the bulimia was 10 years ago, They'll get put on something like Nexium, which is a proton pump inhibitor to stop the stomach acid, which, let's face it, is probably already fucked up from, you know, from the bulimia. And then they get popped on like a PPI to keep stomach acid suppressed, so that there's no more further damage, you know, from you know, hydrochloric acid to that esophagus. But then the PPI perpetuates what's probably already going on with their gut, which is, like Jess just mentioned, more commonly SIBO. So we see that quite a lot. Yeah, like I think it's just, I've definitely had clients and someone quite close to me in our family. So she's like, I just don't understand why I have to be on, why I'm like, she's 40 now, my age actually, a year younger. And she's like, I just don't understand why I need to be on Nexium. Like, I was bulimic 20 years ago. I'm like, because you did the damage then, mate. Like, and what, you know, the risk of, you know, that esophageal damage left untreated, you know, is, you know, I'm not going to say all the, you know, doom and gloom words, but, you know, they're just trying to do the best to manage it because the damage is already done.
Yeah.
So, you know, like it's, that's 20 years on for, you know, the person I'm talking about. And I see that a lot with clients too. Like, they'll get popped on a PPI and then, you know, they might be not okay, but micromanaging their gut. And then, yeah, they end up with, like you said, that IBS SIBO style picture.
So true. Yeah. The other thing too is like the structure and function of the digestive system as like, as organs, like this, you know, you probably talk about this with hormones too, you know, when you're severely starved of calories over months and months and years, like that is going to literally affect those organs. Like there's, you know, there's a reason why the extreme of eating disorders ends in death. We were like Jessica bringing up death again in a podcast, but you know, like it's these you know, organ shutdown essentially is where things end up going, and the body is going to go into self-preservation mode. It's going to find other ways to break down tissue and look for some form of calorie to keep itself alive. And I know that sounds really extreme, but like this is what we're seeing in some cases where the actual structure and function of the gastrointestinal tract is being affected. And or on top of that, its ability, I think even more so, to repair. So if someone is like, they already have issues with their gastrointestinal tract because of what we've talked about, but they actually don't have the building blocks to repair. So they can't, like, they're not getting enough nutritionally coming in on a day-to-day basis to like give the cells within the lining of the gastrointestinal wall to regenerate. They're not like giving those, again, those building blocks to the body to like do what it needs to do to deal with inflammation. Like it's, you know, our body runs literally on nutrition and what we give it on a day-to-day basis. So if we don't have that there, how can our digestive system even work and thrive and work as organs properly?
I also think like the recovery space as well can look so different for so many people. Like, and we definitely see this go probably one of two ways. Recovery just literally, like, I know this like recovery in mainstream medicine literally just means you're no longer at risk of losing your life. You know what I mean? Like that's where we don't need to intervene anymore. So therefore you're kind of in recovery. So you know, like, which probably sounds a little bit harsh, but you know, the recovery space for so many people looks so different. Some people are, when they, by the time they come to us, are literally still recovering as far as I'm concerned. And this could be 10 to 15 years down the track, but it's also how they've recovered. So, you know, the mainstream medical model is just really good at pumping in calories into people with disorder, and this is obviously the people that are definitely more in the anorexia bulimia space that end up being hospitalized, but the mainstream model just really focuses on calories over nutrition as far as I'm concerned. And so, you know, when we're talking about a gut needing certain tools and proteins and anti-inflammatory, you know, compounds and, you know, mucosal building compounds to repair itself, I'm sorry, but high sugar loaded, shitty oil loaded, gluten and dairy loaded substrates are not what it needs for recovery. And I think, you know, so depending on how people have come out of a disordered eating space and where they've gone with that post, you know, post hospitalization, or even just depending on how they've worked with it, whether they've gone down the health road. Like, I know, I'll probably say the healthy eating road, and really focused on clean food and all of that, or whether or not they haven't and they've kind of just gone, well, I'm just going to eat whatever and keep my weight up. Obviously, too, is going to have massive impacts on, you know, the microbiome and its ability to heal too. So I think that recovery space can look so different for everyone, and just depending on their journey and where they've sort of ended up will dictate so largely as to the state of the microbiome. From a structural point of view too, like, just I think like the laxative space, I know I mentioned that before, but when we talked about doing this, I was like, this is something I see a lot with clients. They're very, like, the clients that are very open with me, they're like, oh yeah, I just used to use laxatives all the time. If I wasn't vomiting, I'd just, you know, take laxatives. And, you know, if that's been going on for a period of years, like, again, this comes back to, you know, the large bowel, like, you know, I think laxatives, depending on what people have taken, are either just a stimulant or something that draw a lot of water into the bowel and cause a flush out. But effectively what we're doing is causing a lazy bowel, because the bowel forgets how to work as a muscle, how to actually deal with fiber. It never actually gets the digestive capacity and time to work out what to do with fiber and how to, you know, work as a muscle or as a functioning organ. So it's essentially just holding waste product and then having an influx of water or a stimulant to flush it out. So depending on the years of, you know, laxative use for people as well, can really fundamentally change for years and decades down the track what you're going to be prone to. And a lot of those people are more prone to constipation because their bowel doesn't understand and hasn't been trained or taught how to work as a muscle, and it's forgotten how to do that. So you know, that's something I see quite a bit when people are quite honest with their sort of history. So I'm like, okay, cool, that's really important for me to know, because I know now not only we are looking at, you know, building your gut microbiome up, but we've really got to work at that, you know, structural muscular sort of level and train it. And it's going to be a hard road. Like retraining a muscle that hasn't worked properly for two decades is not something that happens in a month or 2 months. So
yeah, no, very true. I was thinking too about, I mentioned it before, about intolerances, like food intolerances, but when you're talking about the sort of recovery space with particularly hospital treatment and like the refeeding and so forth that happens, I know, and I know you would too, have seen so many clients who have struggled with this, where they feel they've got this array of food intolerances, but again, that makes sense because of like what's been happening to their microbiome for so long, and their immune system doesn't have the capacity just to deal in the same way as the average person potentially off the street with the building blocks, again, just to like not have these heightened immune symptoms or responses. But essentially, like with everything going on in the gut, like the ability for them to become more reactive makes sense, and particularly to some of these common reactants like gluten and dairy, and then a lot of the refeeding liquids, as you said, are based on these. So they start like having this like really horrible cyclic relationship with working on increasing their calories and going through this like refeeding and trying to put on weight, but they're consuming these products that are like highly inflammatory to them because their gut can't deal with them. I've seen some, thankfully there's some newer products that are coming out in the market which are helping here, but it just, yeah, you just see where it becomes this vicious cycle. But yeah, the food intolerances is definitely a big aspect as far as people feeling like they have multiple reactivities, and that's something for us as practitioners, as far as the long-term implications that we find we have to pick apart, and we'll probably talk about this a bit later, as far as like what's actually a true intolerance versus when you've had this relationship with food, you can create rules around food as far as like, I don't eat this or I don't eat that, or I can't eat this and I can't eat that because it causes X, Y, Z. You know, and that's part of our job to be able to kind of pick that apart and figure out what's like eating disorder behavior, the psychology that's still there, and what's true to the gut.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like that's it's a tricky space to navigate, because I think because when you're working with such a complex condition, I always, if I'm working with people, they're really still stuck in the eating disorders, mental health part of it, like the psychology of it, like I always get into work with a psychologist as well. But I think Like I've had this conversation. I've got a beautiful client at the moment and she has come so far, but we are so honest with each other about what I think is eating disorder behavior and and I just call it. I'm like, no, that's your brain telling you that that food's not safe. And I don't actually believe that's going to be a true intolerance for you, but that's not going to be the same for every person. And you have to kind of get to know that person and their personality, but also their microbiome to understand, you know, because I just don't, this is probably a bit of a loaded statement, but I just don't believe that someone is generally sensitive to everything. I think that's, you know, with eating disorder behavior, I think there's a lot of that, like salicylates, histamines, gluten, dairy. Yes, you might feel like you are, but what we're actually dealing with is a microbiome that's so compromised that it feels like you're reacting to everything, but also your brain's still telling you that you are. Yeah. So trying to pull that apart is fucking tricky, but also, you know, like but like you said, like finding what the true intolerances are for someone versus the mindset around I'm just too scared to bring food back in because I've told myself and created this story around this food or this type of food, whether it be carbohydrates or fats, I've created a story around why I can't consume them. It's a lot. So I definitely think, like, depending on where people are at and with their recovery and what we're working with, like having some extra professionals on the team is really important. Like I know for one of my clients, like I tell her what we're going to be trialing and I get her to tell her psychologist. Especially for some of the high trigger foods like eggs, like, you know, something like that, that she's like, they might be convinced that eggs are the issue. I'm like, well, eggs are a high allergen, so it's definitely a possibility. You know, eggs create issues from sulfur point of view, all of this. So we know that eggs could potentially be a trigger, but I'm also aware that you may just not want to bring a protein back in right now. So it's a big space.
And the thing is too, I'm sort of jumping ahead as usual with as we tend to do, but like it's a behavior that you can transfer. Like it's a very strong disorder that perhaps like you've worked through as far as the control around the food, but what we will see is that it will shift to control somewhere else, and that's where like the control around the food from a health point of view in quotation marks around like what's going on your gut can be potentially problematic. Like it's you may look at it and go, well, I'm not in the eating disorder anymore, but the control has now shifted to being around like what foods that you can handle for your gut and what causes bloating and what causes this and that, or like how you control how you structure the food in the day or whatever it may be. But it's often can create a shift in the control because essentially that's what the disorder's about, right? So that's where it's great, as you said, working if there's a psychologist involved and being able to like work on your health with someone like a clinical nutritionist, but also having that psychological support at the same time.
That psychological support to really help them rationalize when they're being rational with themselves, I think is super important. And to watch someone, like we're talking about probably more the early stages of recovery here, but to watch someone push through those barriers is amazing, because I honestly think like the mind fuck that your mind will play on you when you're in the depths of an eating disorder and you're coming into your probably your first, maybe your second attempt at recovery, third attempt at recovery, whatever it is, it's a fucking brutal space. But those people, when you see them make the gains where they're like, no, fuck this, I'm not listening to my brain tell me this about this food, and I'm actually going to try it and I'm going to see what the impacts are on my microbiome. And if there is a little bit of an upset, I've had the chat with my nutritionist, I understand what's expected and normal by bringing a new food in. It may not be smooth sailing, but I'm going to push on anyway. They're fucking brave, man. Like that's some of them, you know?
For sure.
When I have my clients.
It's terrifying for them. It's terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. And I do think, like, you know, like sometimes I feel like when it doesn't seem like a lot to people who haven't been through it, but for my clients that have been through it, when they have those little wins and those little wins against their own, like their own mindset, and just gives them that little bit of strength and that little bit of, you know, like, I'm just like, fuck, you're brave. I'm so proud of you.
So proud of your brain.
So proud of your brain right now. Didn't let it win this time over the, you know. But yeah, it's a messy and yeah, it's an all consuming space. But then, yeah, like when we're kind of on this other side of it, like you said, where it still triggers control around food, like that control can go on for years. And I think that's definitely something.
I don't think it ever goes away.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I guess it's just, I mean, okay, I should maybe not put such a sweeping comment in there. I'm sure there's some people that it does, but I kind of see it as something that, it's like being an alcoholic, you know, like you go to, if you are lucky enough to go to AA and you stop drinking, like it's always there. It's always this little seed that's back there. And I think with something like this, I don't think it ever truly goes away. I think you can be like in such an amazing like space for the rest of your life, and that's great. But I think it's always there in some capacity, and like that element of control that comes with that is probably is something that people just need to be conscious of and manage in how it's expressed. Yeah. It could be expressed and used in a really beautiful, beneficial way, but I don't know.
I also think just being aware of, just being aware of your own, you know, your own, I guess, journey in the space wherever you are, just knowing to your triggers, which is really important for us as a practitioners. Yeah. And I think that's why it's really important to be honest with us about that stuff, because just like if we do anything, because obviously too, when you know, for us, and I know we've talked about this in other podcasts many moons ago, but you know, part of our job as healing the gut microbiome involves some form of restriction at some point, you know what I mean? Not with all clients, but you know, if we're putting some, or if someone comes to me and they've got some gut stuff but they also want to lose weight, like we're working a fine line in the restrictive space if we've got people that have got eating disorder triggers, and you know, you have to have that chat with your client, like, I'm okay to do this, but you need to be fucking honest with me if this becomes triggering for you. Especially gluten's not such a big one to lose and stuff like that, but if we're starting to look at things like FODMAPs or quantities of FODMAPs, which I try not to let people get too caught up in, because fucking who wants to do that? Boring. not my clients. But you know what I mean? It's just that you can quite easily see how people can become quite triggered again, no matter how much of a good space they're in.
Yeah.
That niggly thing is in the background, and the, you know, you give them the permission to restrict food. Be for health reasons, you've just got to be so careful that that's not a
absolutely
spiral. Yeah. Yeah.
What about hormones?
Oh, hormones, baby. hormones are epic in this space. I have so many women that I have these conversations with, and again, depending on where you've come from, but let's talk about probably girls that have been probably a bit more, had a fair crack, I shouldn't say a fair crack in the disordered eating space, but being in it. That's a fair crack. I mean, like, I think about people like my sister, for example, who their weight did get way too low. They did end up in hospital. You know, like they were in the depths of it for quite a while. And as far as a fair crack goes, they lost their period, dropped their weight, and all of that. So for anyone that's been in that space, even if you haven't ended up in hospital, but you've lost your period during any of these restrictive eating, and it can just be healthy eating, but overtraining. I don't want to forget that, because I've got some clients that, you know, they eat a really beautiful calorie dense diet, but they outtrain it.
Yeah.
So that is still disordered eating, you know, and so it's just kind of like when we're working with the period in that space, like it's really important to remember that the damage done to the microbiome and the impacts on the microbiome are far reaching, but it is exactly the same with the hormones.
Yeah.
So from a, like, I guess from a hormone, like an androgen point of view, it's really important to remember if you're someone who has lost a significant amount of body fat, whether it be if you're under eating or overtraining, if you've lost a significant amount of body fat and you lose your period as a result of that, your androgens naturally become your dominant hormone because mm-hmm. you don't have circulating estrogen or estrogen. So, and you don't have progesterone and you're not ovulating. So what we see, the rebound effect of that when the period comes back is more commonly a lot of these girls stay, I would say, in a more androgen dominant state. And PCOS can become a thing for sure. I definitely feel like that's probably more common post, more intense eating disorder. And that's what I say to my clients, their skin, they can have a lot of the skin concerns. And so we talk around like the androgens, but also just even DHEA and the impacts of that. If there's still a really high stress picture, you might be in eating disorder recovery and you might be good and eating well and not overtraining and doing all the right things. But if you're still hyper-stressed and androgens have been allowed to become your dominant hormone, either because of disordered eating or purely genetics or a combination of both, that high DHEA output is going to have some big impacts. The other thing is too, then understanding that, into this space feeds a lot the hypothalamic amenorrhea. So, we've got these kind of, I call them shy hormones. And for a long period of time, your period is going to be more sensitive. She may just fuck off because you're a little bit stressed. And for someone else, I say that, this is how I explain it to my clients. It's like, I'm like, she's shy and she doesn't feel safe. Yeah. And because she's gone through this intense, stressful period, pun not intended, but this mm-hmm. is intense stress, stressful, intense couple of years or 5 years or 10 years where, she wasn't around and the brain literally took her away, but she's trying to come back. And that recovery space of the hormones can take, 5 to 10 years, depending on what sort of work's being done. And I explain it to my clients, it's just like, your nervous system remembers and your hormones remember. Mm-hmm. And so they're not just because you're a healthy weight now and you're exercising, they're not just going to go, oh, cool, we'll just drop ovulation back in every month. That you've triggered your nervous system into a type of response. You have to train it to feel safe again, and that takes time. So there's what actually happens with the period in terms of regularity that we have to work with in the post eating disorder or the recovery space. There's definitely the potential for androgen dominance, but then I think a lot in the yo-yo dieting space and the ups and downs and gaining weight and losing weight and all of that, there's definitely, again, it's just that dysregulation of the HPA axis and again allowing the body to feel safe, but depending on what's happened with the liver and the gut and all of that, we can see a lot of estrogen dominance or endo. And anyway, so not so commonly related with disordered eating is what I would say the androgen and hypothalamic amenorrhea space is. But again, depending on what your recovery space looks like and where you are 10 or 20 years down the track and what your stress space looks like also plays massively into the hormone space as well. So
we have a brand spanking new meal plan available on our online shop for you called the Easy Meals Food Plan. And as the name suggests, this Easy Meals Food Plan is designed to make healthy eating easy. It provides simple whole food recipes that will leave you still feeling really energized and light and fantastic. The overall goal is to provide these nutritionally approved meals that are designed by clinical nutritionists at the JCN Clinic that can be prepared in under 30 minutes or less. We know that a lot of you are time poor, and this meal plan has been put together because of that demand. Also, with the recipes in the meal plan, not only are they delicious as always, they're easy on the gut, so we know you're going to experience minimal bloating and gut upsets. There's lots of variety in there as far as ingredients to help build a really robust gut and microbiome. There is step-by-step guides for recipes, minimal fuss, lots of easy recipes. All of them have gluten-free and dairy-free modifications if needed. And something we haven't done before is we have also added for you a weekly shopping list that will help you get organized and prepared to make the meals throughout the week even more simple to throw together. We've also included some nutritionally approved brands throughout this meal plan to guide you. None of these are sponsored. It's just sharing with you what we think is A, accessible, and B, works well to provide you the best. So if you're interested in the Easy Meals Food Plan, head to our online shop and just click on Easy Meals Food Plan and you can get that for just $45, which, guys, is an absolute steal. You can also head to the link in our show notes.
Yeah. She's a loaded basket.
That was so well explained, really well explained. And I think I like that you put emphasis on that time frame as well. Mm. I love the analogy of the shyness because,
yeah,
it's so valid and so true as far as like the expectations of like, oh, well, I'm eating enough now and I'm doing X, Y, Z, so where is it? It's just like,
yeah,
your body has to feel safe again, has to learn to be safe. It's like, learned over many, many, many years patterns to hide and protect or to be shy.
But now
it needs to learn that this is a safe environment. And a lot of that, there's all spectrums, isn't there, that we'll see. I mean, there's some women that have actually, if they've had their disordered eating from a younger age, I mean, actually have never menstruated. So you know, just even think of the implications of something like that for someone to then like, to learn, like for their body at whatever age it is, just to even be able to like find the building blocks to do something's actually never done before, like that just blows my mind as well.
Exactly. It's kind of like, you know, building highways where there's bush and thick dense forest. Like it takes time, especially for all of that stuff. But I definitely use the she's shy and she's scared and you have to make her feel safe. And it's not just about eating well, it's about working your stress. It's about managing that adrenal output. And, you know, you might get her back for 3 months or 4 months, but, you know, stress dials up at work and she goes away. I think I see there's a lot in the teaching space. Like I've got a lot of clients in the teaching space that have got these, you know, shy little hormones, whether it's actual PCOS or from an eating disorder or, you know, but these shy little cycles that are so triggered by these stress responses, and they won't get a period their entire school term. I've got like 3 or 4 teachers I can think of at the moment. Like the load on teachers is just exponential in the education system, and, you know, they don't, and as soon as they have their holidays, they get a period, you know, and so it's just those classic patterns of what can we do to reduce your stress because you're eating well and you're moving your body, but, you know, she's shy, you know, as soon as there's that dialed up stress response, it's now a learnt behavior of your nervous system to retract this ovulation the minute she feels like she's unsafe. So, you know, these learnt behaviors in our nervous system, you know, we've got to get in. Yeah. It's crazy, man. I love this space.
Couldn't tell, just
took over.
So I literally handed the microphone over.
Chris, talk about hormones.
It's like, I'm just going to go and get myself a cup of tea. I'll be back in 20 minutes.
Yeah, I'll be back in 20 minutes when you shut up and stop rambling. Oh, it's so true. So true.
I feel like we've already touched on this. As far as like the re-triggering, but we'll just sort of summarize and bring this together. So we've talked about, I mean, there's other areas, health areas of the body, like honestly it's everything that eating disorders have an effect on, but we really wanted to highlight the gut and the hormones today because, I mean, they're a big part of what we do at JCN and they're probably, you know, the main areas that people will come to us about, and probably particularly stereotypically females that are coming in with this past are the main priority points. But definitely just to say, like, absolutely, whether it's like the nervous system, the immune system, like there will be knock-ons into other areas, but we're just focusing on this area today. But what I wanted to talk about is how we have to be careful with potentially re-triggering when we're looking at treatment in this area. And, yeah, we have mentioned this already, but whether it's with us at the JCN clinic or working with practitioners elsewhere, if this is something that resonates with you and it's been, you know, you've had this past and it is something that you want to start actively working with someone on, whether, again, gut, hormones or both, definitely being honest with yourself and your practitioner, as Carissa said earlier, about how you are feeling, because once you start working with your food in particular, and if there are areas within the food that may need to be tweaked or changed, or even just starting to discuss food, just working with someone and talking about food more and being conscious of food more, the re-triggering of that disordered eating behavior can be something that happens. And we're so conscious of this at the clinic, and we'll often work in a lot more of a slower, methodical way, and be very, very cautious of what we're doing with the diet. But even with that, like, I know we've both seen cases where people start to be triggered. And it's just, it's such a frustrating sort of cycle in that, like, we're obviously working with someone to help them feel well and recovered and help their body thrive. But by doing that, we're like having discussions around food and being more conscious of food, and just that alone, before even, like you mentioned before about FODMAPs and so forth, even if we're not even touching anything like that, just the pure discussion around it and being more conscious of it can be a bit of a trigger. So I just think it's a really important aspect to be very self-aware of if you're going into this area and you're seeking help. To be honest with yourself and be honest with your practitioner, because the right practitioner should be aware of this, and we'll be looking for triggers. But I was speaking to one of our practitioners at the clinic today, like, we will be checking in a lot and doing everything that we can, but we need to encourage an open, honest relationship, and ideally, if possible, to have a psychologist on board, because this definitely can be triggering. I don't know so much about how you find, like, I'm thinking gut so much because that's what I attract. But if I was just working purely with hormones and nothing around the gut, I'm not sure so much how triggering that would be. What are your thoughts?
It depends on what's going on with the hormones and why someone's seeing me. Like, generally, if they're seeing me for hormones and it's to get their period back and it's coming from a disordered eating past, then obviously I'm so aware of what's going on with their food and having that conversation. But I was just thinking, I've even seen, this wasn't with me personally, but this is a friend of mine who I also see as a client, but I wasn't doing this work with her. She was doing it with someone else, and she's never had a disordered eating thought in her brain, like, it's just never, but just even going on a restricted diet for body composition actually started to trigger stuff for her. So I think, like, that was really interesting for me to hear, because I was like, geez, I wouldn't have picked that for you, and she's like, neither would have I. She's like, but just that constant, because she's very health conscious, and just that constant, you know, I guess, overanalyzing every little thing that was going into her mouth was enough to just start triggering a negative response with how she was feeling about food and her body. So definitely pulled out of that space. So she was very aware of it and very onto it, which was great before it became anything that it didn't need to go down. But yeah, from the hormone space, I guess it just depends on why people are seeing me. But usually I'm always working with diet and stuff. So I do love it when people are honest, because it just makes me that little bit more mindful as we're doing anything, especially if people are coming to me for weight loss. Weight loss is a big one. And obviously hormones attract weight loss, as does gut stuff. But hormones, I feel like, attract weight loss a lot more. So when people, I think there's a lot of women, you know, who maybe haven't necessarily had an eating disorder per se, and maybe if it's just done yo-yo dieting, but they're in their 40s and their 50s now, and just that bit of weight gain. I know we've talked about this in other podcasts, but that bit of weight gain that happens with perimenopause and menopause, and it might only be 5 or 6 kilos, or, you know, even 4 kilos, but that can be really distressing to some women. And it's not till that happens and they realize that they haven't got that control, sort of thing, and then they kind of come and see me. And I've had this conversation quite a bit lately, because I work so much, I guess, in the perimenopause and menopause space, where they're just like, I actually probably have always had a bit of a control issue with food and exercise, but I've always been able to manage my weight. So and then the minute they can't, which that natural weight gain in menopause and perimenopause happens, and we can get it back down, but it's just all of a sudden, they're like, shit, I actually didn't realize how much of an issue this was from a psychological point of view. And I was actually thinking too, just when you're talking to about clients, as an example, when I first started practicing, probably a couple of years into practice, I had a client who wasn't open and honest with me. I think I've talked about this in another podcast, and that's fine. Like, again, I think you have to trust sometimes, and we've all got our walls up. But she wasn't honest with me, or just probably didn't tell me how much of a control thing she had around her weight and her food. She hadn't necessarily ever had an eating disorder in the past, but just that real control around everything. And we did a SIBO biphasic diet with her, and it actually full on triggered stuff. Like we had to stop her treatment. She had to go and work with a psychologist for months. And I was heartbroken because I was like, fuck, I've done this. Like, I just remember especially being a young practitioner too, like your first couple of years in practice, like you're so much more careful about how you treat and what you do. Like, I'm careful now, but you know, my understanding's so much greater now, and you get to read people better. And I was fucking heartbroken over that. But I just remember thinking, I just wish you told me, and I would never have put you on a biphasic diet. So, that's just, you know, learning as practitioners, but also learning to just, you know, ask people. I think I even ask people now if I'm going to do a really restrictive diet. I'm like, do you have any issues with restriction?
Exactly.
If I even sense something.
So true. And that story just highlights the importance of it to be truthful. Like, I think if you feel you've recovered and it's something from your past, you can be kind of quite prideful about that. And it's just like, I don't even want to talk about it. Like, it's not me anymore. But there's obviously a really important reason for this, as far as what Chris has even just said from like that experience. And I definitely have had that myself, where being open and honest is so important. I feel like for someone that's had this past to work through all of this, like, it can be more challenging, because it does maybe bring up like some old patterns, or maybe challenge you as well. Like, particularly with food, like if you feel like if a disordered eating has been in your past, you may be over that as far as recovery, but you might not realize that you're still carrying, which I was talking about before, some elements of control in how you eat now. So when you work with someone, like, even that alone can be super challenging, because you feel like it's got nothing to do with the eating disorder or old behaviors. It's just something that you're doing out of choice, or maybe it's just you feel it doesn't sit well with you. But there'll be these things that we can come in and challenge you on, and I think that it can make this process quite confronting. But it's just, I mean, it's so, as you said yourself too, it's so beautiful when you see people move through this and have those wins. And we always love seeing anyone have wins, but with something like this, when you see some of those big steps that you know it is for them, that they've like, whether it's a food, they've always told themselves they've got a story around that they can't eat, or whether it's like hitting like maybe goals with their food intake that they've told themselves that, you know, they can't do. It's just so rewarding and so exciting.
Yeah, it's amazing. So good.
Yeah. Is there anything we've missed that you wanted to add? I know we could talk about this forever, but I was trying to keep it
relative. I don't think so. I think just like we say with everything, but in any health journey, I feel the word journey gets used a lot these days, but just be respectful of the time that it takes your body to do things. Like, I think especially if you've got a decade or 5 to 8 years of disordered eating and the psychology and everything that's tied in with those behaviors, like, just be really respectful of your body and the space and the time that it takes to come out of that. But also know that there's going to be elements of things that, you know, may never be perfect, and that's okay. I think that's a big thing. I think, you know, and I know we've talked about this on the bloating podcast and, you know, the healthy poo podcast, all the ones that we've done. Like, I think we're so busy striving for perfection with our health that we kind of forget that we can just be happy. I'm not saying settle, but you can be happy with a well-functioning body, not necessarily a perfect functioning body. And I think that goes for the gut. And I just think, you know, sometimes too, and I know this is like understanding that sometimes the damage that you've done, well, no, I shouldn't say that you've done, but the damage that the disordered eating has done, you know, that I'm not going to say it's irreversible, but it may need ongoing for the rest of your life some level of support, and please make peace with that. Because I think there's a lot of people that think, well, that's done and dusted. I've worked on it. I've done the hard work. I eat well. I do. And you do all the right things, but it doesn't mean that you can't stop giving it attention. You know, like for all of us with our health stuff that we're all working on, like the road is long. The road is long, and there will be elements of your health, if you choose to pay attention to your health and work in this space, as we all do in the holistic health space, where you will have to give things elements of attention ongoing for the rest of your life. And please just make fucking peace with that and try not to let it get to you. It just is what it is sometimes.
Yeah. Well put. Rissy.
My two cents. Mic drop, I'm out.
So we're going to wrap this up with our recommendations. We're going to shift gears. I even gave Carissa a bit of a heads up in our email earlier today, but I reckon, maybe I do know what your recommendation might be considering what we're talking about earlier.
No, I was just thinking, when you said on the email plus our recommendations, I thought you meant just for what we were talking about.
Ah, that's hilarious.
It's like our recommendations for this space. Well, you've obviously got one, so you've thought about it. So let me go first.
All right. I think it's actually quite relevant to this topic in a way. I have just finished, and maybe it was a couple of weeks ago, I read Sally McRae's book called Choose Strong.
Oh, I knew you were reading this.
So good. I can't recommend it enough, particularly I think it's just a beautiful book in general, but in relationship to encouragement and finding strength within yourself under adversity, and just the choices that we make, like whether you've had any sort of adversity in your life, or even if you haven't, like life sometimes can just be shit and throw you curveballs. Like it really is a beautiful read on how we all have a choice in what we decide to do and how we take on life. And it just, yeah, it's beautifully written. It's actually written, she writes as kind of in a way as a young girl. So it's up to about her, I think 18 or 19 is where this book finishes. There'll be another one that'll come out apparently. But yeah, she kind of, the language that she uses and the way she writes it, she'll talk a little bit as if she is still that young girl. So I know some people probably find that a little bit weird to get used to, but you do pretty quickly. It's a very quick read. I sort of demolished it in a day, to be honest. But yeah, you can get it like online. I imagine some bookstores and so forth. I just bought it online, and yeah, I'll put the link in the show notes.
Cool. Is she the ultra?
Yeah.
Cool. I thought it was the same person. Yeah. This will lead on to my recommendation, which is great, because I would be super fucking keen to read that.
Yeah. I'll bring it up for you.
Yeah. Well, when I give you my recommendation, maybe you won't. Because my recommendation is Audible, because I have a problem with my brain. I have several, actually. But no, I can't. Yeah, no, don't worry. I rang up my brother the other day to ask him a question about a roast, because I was doing a roast on a Weber, but it was a rolled rib roast, and it was just a real unco looking fucking chunk of meat. And I was like, fuck, how am I going to cut this? So I rang him up, and this is how I lead with it. I'm like, Trent's like, answers the phone. He's like, hello, Rissy. I'm like, hello, Trent. I'm like, I need help. And he's like, yes, you do. Like, shut up, fucker. I need to ask you something about a roast before I put it on the Weber. Anyway, I don't know what is different about me in my adult life, but I think it's just my brain. I struggle to read. I'm like a goldfish. I can't retain a book. I really struggle to sit down and read a book. Like an autobiography I seem to get into. Like I love reading autobiographies, and I seem to be able to get into them and read them, but still, like, my brain is just such a scatterbrain. I'm so easily distracted. So I don't know why I didn't come across this earlier, but I downloaded Audible a couple of months ago, and this is probably why I've been out of the podcast space, because now all the fucking books on my bookshelves that I'm too scatterbrained to read, I am now actually listening to, and honestly, it has been a game changer for me. So I feel like I would do her book on Audible, and I'll go through it, because I love podcasts, because I can walk around, and sometimes I can't do two things at once. Like if I'm really into it and it's quite meaty, like a book or even a podcast, like I can't cook and do that. I need to just sit down and listen to it, or walk and listen to it. It's sort of, I'm almost like, you know, can't do two things at once. But yeah, Audible for me has changed my brain in terms of being able to digest some of the books. Like I've got a list on there, and I just, yeah, it's what, where my brain is on its spare time at the moment is just devouring these books that I've, you know, had on a list. I screenshot books on Instagram and things, and I'm just like, there's no point in buying it because you can't read it, because you can't sit still for long enough to do that. Like, so that's my recommendation. If any of you sound like me in terms of distractibility and capacity to sit down and relax and read, I can sit down and relax. I just don't want to read. I just want to look at the bush or the trees and watch the birds and, you know, the bugs and stuff like that. But for me, reading a book, I've just really struggled with it over the last 15 years. And this, for me, I think that's why I loved podcasts when they became a thing. I was like, finally, because even for me, when I was studying, like reading and understanding a textbook and research articles and stuff, like it, I had to sit down and print them all out, highlight things in color codes. Like it was just such a process for my brain to pull. And it's not that I'm not smart. I know that I'm a smart person. It's just we all have such different learning abilities. Absolutely. And stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, for me, Audible has, like, I'm just so excited about how many books I can get through now for my brain.
So good. That's my I love it. Very connected, aren't they?
Yeah. So I'm like, don't bring me out of the book. I'll buy it on Audible. So yeah.
It is fascinating, the difference, isn't it? Like I'll go through stages where I'll struggle to read, depending on what's going on, but I actually find it, depending on it has to be a certain type of book as well, but I actually find it very soothing to, like one of my favorite things is on the weekend to wake up and get my matcha and then go back to bed and be able to read in bed. I find that really relaxing. But I could see you just would not be able to do that.
I'm like a fucking pinball machine. And for anyone under 25 that doesn't know what a pinball machine is, Google it and just watch the ball bounce around off everything. That's literally what's going on in my brain at any given time of the day. So, I would love to be able to do it. Like, I love the idea of it. Like, and I've got all of these books and I sit down, I've got all these beautiful relaxation spaces in our house. But, mate, 5 minutes and I'm like, ding, 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 ding. Like, fuck this, not meant to do this.
I love it. Alrighty. Well, thanks everyone as always for listening. Hopefully this has been a really helpful podcast. Please share. You know, we love it when you share these episodes, and particularly something like this would be just really valuable, I'm sure, for others to listen to. So share. Love it if you could just take a couple of moments to head to iTunes and leave us a review. That helps us immensely. But other than that, thanks as always for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.